Are you or is someone you know fighting cancer right now? Are you a cancer survivor? Or have you lost someone to cancer? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk about cancer this hour, its prevention and treatment, and what research might promise for the future. Our conversation is prompted by the documentary Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, which aired on PBS last week. Did you see it? What questions do you have about cancer, its prevention and treatment? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Howard Bailey, a professor of hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the director of the UW's Carbone Cancer Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I saw bits and pieces of the documentary series, and we did on this program a few years ago when the book came out, speak with the author of Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. Did you get to see it, or what have you heard about it?
Well, I've seen parts of it ahead of time that was released to us because we were doing some other work and lectures on it, and of course I've read the book, which, again, as I think you alluded to, is a real great lesson for all of us in kind of the history of how cancer knowledge, education, treatment has advanced over the years.
Mm-hmm. And the book did highlight some of the discoveries made at UW-Madison. Was UW-Madison's research mentioned in the documentary?
Yes, it was in various ways. And so the University of Wisconsin has a long history in cancer research and education, and actually had one of the country's first cancer research departments, Department of Oncology and the McArdle Laboratories for Cancer Research, actually originated in the 1930s and 1940s, one of the first university cancer hospitals back in the 1940s and 1950s. And then in the book, there were some prominent University of Wisconsin cancer researchers featured in the work that they did. The first was Dr. Howard Temin of the McArdle Labs, who won the Nobel Prize for his work in discovering how and why viruses can lead to cancer, and which led to even further discoveries with when people hear about how genes in our body can make us more susceptible to cancer, and which was an important part of our understanding of many different types of cancer. And then on fronts that were probably more directly related to clinical care, Dr. Paul Carbone, who the cancer center is named after, was one of the originators of the idea of using chemotherapy right after surgery, or what we now call adjuvant chemotherapy in breast cancer, an idea that he principally, but along with a few others at around the country, came up with in the 1960s and early 1970s. And then another prominent University of Wisconsin cancer researcher featured in the book and mentioned some in the show is Dr. Craig Jordan, who traveled from England and eventually was working here at the University of Wisconsin and was one of the main people to discover and explore how to use the anti-estrogen medication called tamoxifen, which has been used and shown to be of value in the treatment and prevention of breast cancer.
Yeah, big breakthroughs there. So we'll talk more about some of the research that is going on right now a little bit later, but let's kind of do a 101, Cancer 101. What is cancer?
So cancer is essentially the change in our normal cells that then become markedly abnormal. So cancer, for lack of a better way of saying it, is us, in that all cancers are derived from our own cells, and that our own cells decide to go awry, or if we use a Star Wars analogy, they go from the good side to the bad side of the force. And how that happens is obviously one of the mysteries that it was described a bit in the documentary, and certainly is described a bit in the book. And it's things that we're still studying, because there are some cancers that we have a very good idea of why that happens and others that don't. But so cancer is our own cells that decide to go bad, and then they start behaving badly. Again, if we use lots of TV analogies here, and that they start growing and they start spreading in ways that obviously we do not want. And once these cells do that, they give us the signs and symptoms that we know to be cancer, whether it's a mass growing in some part of our body or whether it's spread of cancer. And another part that sometimes people slightly misunderstand with the cancer is that cancer gets named by the type of cell in our body that it arises from. And there are many different types of cells in our body, and the cancers then get named according to the type of cell and where it originates, whether that's breast carcinoma or lung carcinoma or colon carcinoma or prostate, or if it arises from blood cells, which is where leukemia or lymphoma comes from, or if it arises from the structure of our body, which is what sarcoma, which is a type of cancer, arises from. And that, just like if we use the analogy of if you have a dandelion in the front of your yard, and then you get new dandelions in the back of your yard, what we know with cancer is that it's the same type of cells, but they spread around. And it's why if someone unfortunately has cancer of the colon and it spreads to a different part of the body, we still call it cancer of the colon, even in this new part, because it's the same weed, if we use that analogy. So cancer is our own cells that have turned and become different and aggressive enough that they then grow unchecked and unfortunately then spread. And just by their overwhelming numbers and location, our bodies cannot survive that. It's again, the analogy I'm going to use is once you have too many weeds in your yard or garden, eventually the good plants or your garden dies out because it just cannot compete against all the weeds.
Well, that's actually very, very helpful and very clear as to what's going on there. But do we know what might prompt our cells to go awry? Are we sure what causes? We hear smoking can do this, or bad dietary habits could contribute to this. Are we sure, or do we know what causes our cells to go awry, and why it would happen maybe in one person and not another?
So, great question, and the quick answer is, for some cancers, we are quite sure, and for others, we are not. But to give examples, you mentioned tobacco or smoking. So tobacco is one example of things from our environment that lead to enough changes. And how does tobacco cause cancer? So if you're constantly exposed to chemicals from your environment that cause cellular damage or inflammation, and that's essentially what tobacco is, and that within tobacco, there are literally hundreds of natural chemicals, and some not so natural, but chemicals that when the cells are exposed to them, it causes the cells to get damaged. And the more you damage a cell, and the more it has to try and repair itself, the more opportunity is for changes to happen, if you will, within the machinery of the cell to have it go down the wrong path. It would be kind of like the more times you tinker with an engine and the more times you start it and stop it and start it and stop it, eventually there's the potential that one of your changes is going to make the engine run very poorly and misbehave or even break. So cancer, for many of us, is repeated exposures to things, whether from our environment that are man-made or natural, that cause cellular damage, and that damage, as it recurs over months and usually years, leads to gradual changes within the cell that eventually tip it to become cancerous. Now, another way that cancers arise can be that, again, we get a virus, and the most common examples that we hear about would be like cervical cancer, which is 99% or 100% caused by the human papillomavirus, or some forms of head and neck cancer, which are caused by the same virus. You get infected by the virus, by exposures. The virus gets into your normal cells, and within the virus, there are certain viral functioning materials that get into our then normal cell and start causing it to misbehave, changing how it acts.
We'll pick up on the causes of a cancer, and we'll talk more about the treatment of cancer after we return from this news. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dr. Howard Bailey. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Joy Cardine. We are welcoming your questions about cancer, cancer causes, prevention, or treatment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We also welcome any experiences you've had with cancer, be it with yourself or someone you love. How has cancer touched your life? We are talking about cancer following the extensive documentary about cancer that aired on public television stations last week, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. If you missed it, it is available to watch online, and I'll bet it will be repeated as well. That documentary did feature some of the breakthroughs that were discovered at the University of Wisconsin, and we are talking with the director of the UW's Carbone Cancer Center, Dr. Howard Bailey, a professor of hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Bailey, cancer rates have been increasing over the last decades. Do we know why this is?
Well, there are some cancers that we know have been increasing and others that have been decreasing in incidence. There's different thoughts on it. We know some of the cancers that have been most strongly associated with tobacco use are gradually decreasing as the tobacco use diminishes. But cancers that have been associated with obesity or being overweight are on the increase. And one of the thoughts, and there's been a lot of national attention to it, is that obesity can lead to and does seem to increase the incidence of certain cancers. And the thought being that obesity leads to inflammation, which then leads again to this constant cellular damage. So those are some of the thoughts as to why some cancers are increasing.
What are some of the cancers associated with obesity?
Well, those include endometrial cancer for women or cancer of the uterus. Breast cancer is associated with obesity. There are some cancers of your swallowing tube called the esophagus and or the upper part of the stomach that have been associated with obesity, as well as some other cancers of the lymph glands that have been associated with that. And again, the thought is that the more fat cells you have, the more inflammation that tends to occur throughout your body.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a scope of how big is the problem of cancer? How many people are getting it? How many people are dying from it?
Right. So cancer, as alluded to in the documentary, cancer is something that has been with us for thousands upon thousands of years and has been a part of the human experience maybe forever. And so cancer is something that, as unfortunately the audience well knows, affects all of us in one way or the other through friends, family, or acquaintances. So cancer is something that happens in the United States, and it affects anywhere from 1 in 3 to sometimes as high as 1 in 2 when you count that the most prevalent cancer in the United States is what's called non-melanoma skin cancer, which is squamous cell cancer and basal cell cancer, which are both associated with sun exposure in lighter-skinned individuals. months ago, while in some respects the cancer incidence in the United States is actually gradually decreasing, the worldwide cancer incidence is increasing because of, again, the cancers that are associated with viral infections, cancers that are associated with tobacco use, which is increasing in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a vast problem.
Yeah. In terms of, I lost a close friend to cancer just recently. I certainly had many other loved ones and friends in the past, but this recent death was from lung cancer. This man was a smoker. He had surgery. He had chemotherapy. He had radiation. It was thought that this might be able to stop it. It did not. It came back. In some people, though, when they go through the chemo and the radiation, it does stop it. Give us some idea why it works sometimes and doesn't in other cases.
All right, thank you. And again, my condolences to you, and again, all the people in the audience who've been have lost loved ones to cancer. But an example with lung cancer, and so a thing to first off, whenever a cancerous tumor is found, one of the things that we go over with people is the reason why it is so scary for all of us is that cancer is almost more an issue with what we don't see than what we see. And again, I'm going to go back to my kind of weeds in the garden analogy, which is that when we find a tumor, in this case in the lung, and it gets removed, it's akin to going out and finding a weed in your yard or garden, and when it's an isolated event, our common practice would be to remove it, to pull it out. Or if we find a tumor, it's to remove it. And that is an important first step. The catch always is, just like if I have that weed in my yard, is it's one thing to get it out. The next part is, has it spread? Did it send out seeds? And the issue with all cancers is that, which is, did it already spread around the body, maybe even years before we found it? So with lung cancer, a problem is that even when we find it as one spot in the lung and remove it, it has a high likelihood that it had already sent out seeds to other parts of the body. So for your friend, they go through surgery and have it removed, and they go through radiation, which can try and better get rid of any cells that are left behind in the local area. And then the chemotherapy, again, much like the weed killer you use out in your yard or garden, is hopefully going to get rid of everything else. The catch, of course, is that, and this is on us that we have to get better, is that our medicines can be quite effective sometimes, and they are, but unfortunately there are also times they're not effective enough in that they do not get rid of or eradicate all the cells we need them to get rid of so that the cells survive and come back. So when a cancer comes back or recurs, it's not that it actually recurs, it's that it never left. It's that the seeds were there, and then they eventually grew up to where we found them again.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dr. Howard Bailey, a professor of hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He is the director of the UW's Carbone Cancer Center. If you have a question or an experience with cancer, we welcome it at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go to Kevin in Madison. He's our first caller. Hi, Kevin.
Yes. Hi, Joy. Good morning to you and Dr. Bailey. My question is, my father was diagnosed and went through treatment for stage 4A throat cancer about 2 years ago, and the treatment completely destroyed his salivary glands and taste buds. He's been on a liquid diet for the past 2 years, losing weight substantially. And I wanted to know, is there any possible way to repair the salivary glands so he could get his taste back, so he feels that he can eat solid food again. And it also, when he has no salivary glands, there's dry mouth in at night when he sleeps, so he can't sleep. Any foods, vitamins, is there anything you could do to repair that?
Thank you, Kevin, for the question. The reason that he is suffering from the dry mouth and the lack of the liquid that are that is produced by our salivary glands or the parotid glands is most likely because of the radiation he received. And that radiation is a wonderfully effective thing at getting rid of the cancer cells. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. it will also destroy to certain degrees some of the normal cells that are in the path. And that, again, it's one of the things that we continue to try and strive to figure out how we can have very effective treatments like that, but with less side effects. And unfortunately, he's having some of the side effects of that treatment. So as he's unfortunately well noting to you, it gets to the fact that having liquid in your mouth is very important to being able to get it down correctly, even to taste it. The radiation then caused the damage to those cells. There are some medicines that work to varying degrees to try and stimulate more salivary production in areas of the mouth that weren't affected as much by the radiation. If your doctors haven't tried those, there are medicines like that. There are techniques that people use, and this won't help them at night, with even things as simple as some of the gums and candies, anything that will increase his salivation or liquid production in his mouth to help with that, are the main things. Mm-hmm. Are there nutrients and foods and other measures? I know there are people that have tried acupuncture and other things like that to varying degrees. I don't know that there's been a lot of success with that, but people have tried that as well. Some people over the years will say that certain foods go better and maybe help with that production. But so there are some medications that, if they have not been tried, that can help increase the salivary gland production. But unfortunately, it's also true that there can be these long-term residual side effects that we need to keep trying to improve on. As we get better at getting rid of cancer, we have to get better at making the treatments less toxic.
Kevin, good luck to your father and to you. Kevin mentioned that his father was recently cured of stage 4 throat cancer. I wanted to follow up on that. First of all, can you briefly describe, stage 4 is supposedly the most advanced?
So if we go through the staging for cancer, it's a kind of a quick way to think of it. Stage 1 means that it's a cancer confined to just one area where you found it in some part of our body. Stage 2 usually means that it's cancer that's in that one part of the body with some local spread in the same area. Stage 3 generally means that the cancer has spread to what we would call regional areas that are adjacent to the one part where it started. And then stage 4, as you said, Joy, mm-hmm. implies that cancer is involved more areas and has more distant spread or size that makes the treatment harder.
Yeah. Well, and just speaking generally, if this was 2 years ago and he does not have, apparent cancer, does that mean cured or remission or likelihood of it coming back?
So, again, good question. Mm-hmm. The terms that people hear, so the main term that anyone, once they've had cancer, it's either removed or it's treated in such a way that there's no longer any evidence of active cancer. We call that a remission, meaning there are no signs of it. What remission means is unfortunately only that, which is we do not see it. We hope it isn't there, but we don't see it. And ultimately, only time tells us whether it will come back or not. Cure implies that it's never coming back, that the original cancer was treated and is now no longer present and never will be present again. So with any person who's gone through cancer treatments, whether it's at 1 year or a few years, we cannot necessarily say they're cured for sure. We certainly hope they are, and we think there's a good chance of that. But the more accurate term for most cancer survivors is that they're in remission and that there are no signs of the cancer, and they and their doctors are hoping it never comes back and that they, in fact, will be cured.
How hereditary is cancer? If a family member dies of a specific cancer, how likely might it be that we are at risk for that?
So again, an important and question for all of us and the listeners. So cancer and heredity comes in kind of two forms. The most common form that we tend to think of is where I inherit a gene or a part of one of my parents. And that gene, which is, you know, the building blocks and the signals for all our cells, causes me to get cancer at some point in my life. A direct inherited path of cancer is actually uncommon. It may only occur in 5% to at most 10% of all cancers. We know that there are some forms of breast and ovarian cancer that a woman can directly inherit the risk from their parent, and their lifetime risk, if they inherit it, can be as high as 50 to 60% of getting a cancer. But again, of all breast and ovarian cancer, that is uncommon and is anywhere from 5 to 10% of all of those. There is the likelihood that all of us can inherit some susceptibility or some risk of cancers. And so we know that if there's a certain type of cancer that happens in our parent or a brother or sister, we know that our risk of that cancer goes up slightly, but not a lot. So inheritance matters, not as much as people tend to think, but it certainly matters to some degree.
We will, Jocelyn in Sheboygan is with us. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. My mother died 50 years ago this month from cervical cancer, and the actual cause of death ended up to be her kidneys failed. But they were doing the same treatment, with radiation. They would pack her with all this, you know, stuff to, for radiation. And it seems to me that treatment is pretty much the same as it was 50 years ago, and there was not much better improvement. I mean, if I would get cancer, I'd be scared to death from having to go through. I heard the other day that it was Julia Sweeney's brother. He had to have spinal taps every day, and it got so bad that he was scarred, and they had to end up putting they called it a spigot.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jocelyn, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have just a minute before a newscast. You know, maybe I'll let Dr. Bailey consider this question over the news in terms of how have cancer treatments changed in the last 50 years. Jocelyn's example was cervical cancer, thinking it hasn't changed much in the last 50 years. We'll ask Dr. Bailey if that's the case, and talk about some advancements in research. What promises does research hold? We have Robert on Twitter who wants to know how promising the personalized cancer vaccines tested at Washington University might be, and what questions you might have. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dr. Howard Bailey, who is the director of the UW's Carbone Cancer Center. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the director of the University of Wisconsin's Carbone Cancer Center and welcoming your questions about cancer prevention and cancer treatment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our conversation is prompted by the PBS documentary that aired last week but is available to view online. In fact, if we haven't already, we will be sure to post a link on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page so you can see the documentary series, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. University of Wisconsin cancer researchers and research highlighted in that documentary. Dr. Howard Bailey, our guest, a professor of hematology and oncology at the UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. Just before our news break, Dr. Bailey, we heard from a caller who said her mom died of cervical cancer 50 years ago, and she said the radiation treatment her mom went through was brutal, and she doesn't seem to think that the treatment has changed much over the last 50 years when it comes to cervical cancer. You want to comment on that?
Sure, and again, my thoughts go out to Joycelyn, whose mother died many years mm-hmm. ago from cervical cancer, and some of her thoughts are correct in that many of the treatments are the same as they were 50 years ago, and the principles behind some aspects of it, which is that with cervical cancer, that the hallmark of treatment is still either surgery or radiation therapy with or without chemotherapy, and that what the message really gets at is that those treatments can have a great deal of side effects. Now, for some women, they can be incredibly effective and lead to cures of cancers that years ago we were unable to cure. But it's also true that they do leave side effects that can be years in the making. And there are changes that are going with how we apply those. Radiation is much different now and is applied in slightly different ways, but it's still the same concept and the same with chemotherapy. So on one level, that thought is correct. On the other level, there have been great, great achievements in the last 50 years, and the cure rates are much, much higher now than they were 50 years ago. But it hallmarks the fact that we still are and still need to keep doing a great deal of research at getting better, finding even more effective treatments, finding treatments that are less toxic or less hard on people. And it gets into a little bit of even the other question that was posed by Robert about personalized vaccines, which is that there's a lot of research going on at many places in the country, the University of Wisconsin, other places that were mentioned, and it has to do with ways to try and stimulate the immune system to do more of the cancer fighting for us. Again, because cancer is ourselves, it's our own cells, the immune system can struggle with trying to recognize and effectively get rid of cancer cells compared to normal cells. So there's a great deal of research going on with ways to try and make the immune system work better, whether it's through blocking how cancer cells protect themselves from the immune system, or altering our immune cells, which there's been a great deal of recent news shows and talks about that, whether it's the polio virus, whether it's using other viruses to stimulate and change our immune cells to more effectively battle cancer. So that gets into more of this personalized approach, because the original question and comment gets at that our treatments are not very specific, which leads to toxicity. And more we are working at trying to come up with much more specific treatments that are targeted only against the cancer cells.
Yeah. Well, and while it's not necessarily treatment, cervical cancer now is there's the vaccine to prevent cervical cancer. That's a fairly new breakthrough, isn't it?
That's correct, Joy. And that certainly a big thing that we and other places that do a lot of cancer research are focusing more and more on our cancer prevention. A lot of the research mm-hmm. that we do and we lead multiple other large universities on behalf of the National Cancer Institute to test and try and discover new and better cancer prevention agents. Many of them are either nutrient-based or vaccines or things like that. So there is an approved vaccine. It's a vaccine against the human papillomavirus, And because the human papillomavirus, which is a virus that causes, as best we can tell, all cervical cancers, there is great deal of work and evidence to suggest that if we are vaccinated against that virus, thus never getting that viral infection, we will not get cervical cancer or some of the cancers in it. This applies to men as well, whether it's cancers of the penis or, for men and women, cancers of the throat or mouth, which are associated with this virus. So there is a great deal of work, and we are pushing nationally to try and encourage more and more people to have their young boys and girls get vaccinated against the human papillomavirus so that they do not go on to unfortunately develop cervical or certain other cancers, which unfortunately, as we heard from our one caller, led to the death of their mother. And that prevention more and more is a way that we can further decrease the burden of cancer on all of us.
Our next caller is Teresa from Madison. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling. I'm wondering if you have any evidence of a connection between emotional health and cancer.
Thank you, Teresa. So the question being, how our emotions, our moods, our sense of well-being, and how that affects our cancer risk and how cancers develop and are treated. And at face value, I would agree probably with Teresa's sentiment. It's hard not to imagine that our mood or the stress we're under or those things couldn't affect or make us more susceptible to cancer. The research on it has said that there are some evidences that stress and things like that can seem to certainly impair our immune system, which ultimately can lead to greater risk of cancer. But there's also been studies that have not necessarily shown that people who feel very stressed or their emotional state is in turmoil, that they have developed cancer at any greater rate than those without it. But certainly, my view and most people's view is that it's hard not to imagine that emotional stress or turmoil impairs our body's ability to work against cancer. Do I think that times of stress literally cause cancer? We don't think that, and there's no evidence to support it, but it certainly could be that cancers could be discovered, or maybe could they even progress or grow slightly more during times of stress. It's certainly possible. The data, like I said, doesn't necessarily strongly support that. But certainly, as with all things in life, we would encourage, whether it's heart disease, cancer, lung disease, Alzheimer's, all those things, that trying to lessen our emotional stress is certainly a good thing.
Thank you, Teresa, for the call. Aaron in Montello is with us now. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I'm just wondering, I'm 27 years old, and I'm not necessarily worried that I have cancer, but I have been a smoker for about 10 years now. And I'm just, I mean, there's the obvious checks for prostate, stuff like that. I was wondering, is there, like, an inexpensive way to check before you have symptoms of cancer, or do you basically just have to wait until you have the symptoms to, you know, check for maybe lung cancer or, like, some sort of lymph node cancer, stuff like that?
Thank you, Aaron. So a couple things. First, what we know with tobacco, that whether a person was a smoker for some period of time or not, to be honest, the sooner a person quits, the less that risk, and eventually that risk goes down to no different than somebody who never smoked. So the risks of tobacco and lung cancer and other cancers are related to how much a person smokes per day and how many years they've been doing it. So if they don't smoke much and they haven't done it for many years and they stop, they can have their risk essentially go away and be comparable to a non-smoker. Now, the great question, it has to do with screening. So there is, in fact, now approved screening for, in this case, lung cancer, which is most commonly associated with tobacco. And it has to do with what's called a low radiation exposure CT scan that has been approved as a and has been shown in studies to be an effective screening for people at high risk of lung cancer. And high risk is defined as people over a certain age, and that age can be anywhere from 50 to 60, and who have smoked a certain amount, meaning what we call pack years. And that has to do with if you smoke a pack a day for 10 years, that's the equivalent of 10 pack years. And to be at high risk, it means to smoke even more than that. But again, any smoking involves some increased risk. It's just if you've smoked a pack a day for 40 years, your risk goes up 20 to 30-fold mm-hmm. over somebody who's never smoked. So there's that insurances cover. If somebody has to pay out of pocket with different hospitals, that cost, again, it's more than we'd like it to be, but can vary from a few hundred dollars. But most insurance companies will pay that.
Dr. Bailey, I hate to rush. You only have a minute left to go. We'll have to do this again sometime. But is there something you can leave us in the final minute, something that's, I guess, hopeful or on the horizon?
Certainly, and I think to follow up on Aaron's question, a key part, I don't ever want people to think that you either just get cancer and you have no control over it, and if you get, you have no control over what happens. And that diagnosis early, screening, living healthy, all those things matter greatly. Just like we were discussing, certainly the best way to treat a problem is to never have that problem, meaning through preventative things.
Mm-hmm.
So screening and healthy living, again, I don't blame the public because you hear so many things that are bad for you, but certainly eating well, being healthy, exercising, avoiding tobacco, avoiding alcohol in excess, all those things can limit and lessen your risk of cancer.
Thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Howard Bailey is a professor of hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the director of the UW's Carbone Cancer Center. This is the Ideas Network.